I have stress because of my living situation, my financial situation. I'm completely supporting myself financially. My father being incarcerated, that's been like basically the biggest strain on me so far. And yeah.
Growing up, I was raised to practice the religion Islam. I was always told that Islam was the right religion and you must follow it or else you would burn in hell. My parents tried to make me read the Quran and pray, but I didn't want to. I was more interested in chasing girls, playing ball, and dressing fly.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio. Thank you for listening. We have a great show today. What you just heard was the beginning of a trailer for this new series that will be running on WNET in New York, which is our PBS affiliate, Channel 13, which are high school kids who have made films with the help of DCTV's resources, people and equipment, but the kids made the films, and they are magnificent, and they're going to be running on PBS on Saturday afternoon, starting this Saturday, tomorrow. And I talked to the founder, one of the founders, the co-founder of DCTV, and his name is John Alpert, and he'll be coming right up in just a few minutes. And it was a spectacular conversation. I was very glad to sit with him, and I really, really loved it. Also coming up, our filmmakers, Tommy Pilato and Femke Wolting, if I pronounced it correctly, and I'm sorry if I might have mispronounced it, but I think I got it. And their film, Last Hijack, which is a very unique hybrid documentary narrative animated film, which is actually screening at the New York Film Festival and will be opening shortly in theaters, and I'll get to that later on in the show. But that's coming up. And then also a conversation with the filmmaker Vanessa Lapa, who also has a documentary called The Decent One about these documents, including letters from Heinrich Himmler, who, of course, is the architect of the Holocaust, the architect of the Final Solution. He's the big Nazi. He's the number two guy. But in his personal life, he wrote letters to his wife, to his daughter. He kept diaries. He had many, many personal photographs. And they were all kind of lost for a while after Himmler was, I guess, captured and the family fled or what have you. The house was empty. American GIs took all these lost artifacts. And the documents have been traveling around the world to some degree. Ended up in Israel. And in the hands of Vanessa's father, who then got it to her, and she made a documentary, and it is amazing. It's currently at the Film Forum, and we'll get to that too. In the meantime, I just wanted to let you know about the New York Film Festival, which is going on. I have been having a great time finally hitting our stride here. Whiplash is a phenomenal film. I just can't see enough about it. I'm hoping eventually we'll get on its filmmaker, Damien Chazelle. That's not going to happen before the theatrical, I don't think. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. But I did want to say this is one of the stronger films I've seen at the festival so far. And I also saw The Look of Silence, Joshua Oppenheimer's documentary, his follow-up to The Act of Killing. And as I record this, yesterday I interviewed Joshua. He had been on the show before, and this is his second time on, so it was great. And we're going to play that episode for you sometime next year when the film comes out. But I did want to say it was, I think, even better than The Act of Killing. But, you know, why compare? People sort of do that, but they're both great documentaries. But I think the thing about The Look of Silence is just there was an emotional connection that's there that wasn't as strong in this, The Act of Killing. But the overall impact is about the same. I mean, just because The Act of Killing was so shocking and so different and so new and something we hadn't seen before, right? So it had that going for it. Anyway, I'm sort of processing all of what I'm seeing at the New York Film Festival, and it's been just terrific. And I've been sitting with a number of the filmmakers. I just sat with Bruno Dumont, who is this filmmaker. He's French, and he has a new film in the New York Film Festival. I saw it at, in Toronto, called Petit Quinquin, or Little Quinquin. And that will, you know, we'll play that down the line a little bit when the film comes out here in the States. But he's a filmmaker who I have an appreciation for, and I've seen a bunch of his films before. And just to sit and talk to people like that. And I just found out, also, I'm going to be sitting with Olivier Assayas, and that's exciting to me because I really love French films. I mean, I love films from many different countries, you know, Iran, Romania, Italy, Mexico, Argentina, Canada. You know, I don't want to even all over Scandinavia. I guess I'm saying I love good films from wherever they come from. But I just, when I've seen like 10 films from a particular filmmaker and then I get the chance to sit down, I just hope I don't, you know, flub it up. I just really all I'm kind of getting at. Okay, let's get right to it, guys. John Alpert is the co-executive director and co-founder of DCTV. He is an award-winning journalist, 11 News and Documentary Emmy Awards, and one National Emmy for sports programming. There you go. This is a guy who has been, fell into filmmaking accidentally, and you're going to hear his origin story right now as I talk to John Alpert. And we're going to talk also about an exciting new program that DCTV is doing with young filmmakers, aspiring documentary filmmakers, my guests in coming years, I guess, you know. And the series is playing on our local PBS station here, WNET. So let's talk with John Alpert, and we'll be back in a little bit after that to talk about our next guest. Thanks. You know, it's a coincidence, John Alpert, that you and I emailed last week, maybe a week and a half ago. I said I wanted to interview you guys because I actually have I've had an ongoing relationship with DCTV, but, you know, now that I've been doing this podcast for a few years, and I like to let the listeners know about organizations like this. I've been talking to Dara for a long time about doing something. Finally, I just said, let me just email you guys. And then the weirder thing happened. Like, the next day, I get an email from Brigade saying, do you want to interview John Alpert regarding this Our Cameras, Our Stories, I guess, was the motivating idea behind it. So you'll talk kind of like into that.
Okay.
Just a little
ready to talk into that.
Thank you. And we've met, actually, but nice to
Yes, I'm...
Is it the synapses starting to pop? And we've it's been a while, but I got came in a couple of times, and I've come to many events over the years, and hosted a couple of things with you guys. And so,
okay.
Yeah, just for some background, you are a founder, right, of DCTV?
I'm one of the founders of DCTV. Keiko Tsuno and I started DCTV a long, long time ago, over 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. How long has it been in the firehouse?
We've been in the firehouse. My daughter was 1 year old when we came into the
firehouse. Don't give her age away. She might get
35,
upset.
35, 36 years.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And now it's exciting as you're actually in the next year or two, we'll see if everything goes as planned, right? A schedule, we'll have a documentary cinema.
Mm-hmm. A fancy documentary cinema that's a place where people can qualify their documentaries for Academy Award consideration.
Meaning it will run for a week?
Yeah, beautiful 4K projector, super duper sound system, separate entrance, places to sit and talk and snack.
Always important.
Cool. Yeah.
Right? We don't have to publish that on this show, but do you have like a rough timeline for that?
We actually were starting, we had a groundbreaking ceremony with lots of documentary heroes here. Michael Moore was here, Morgan Spurlock. It was a really nice event. And we were ready to go, but there we decided to do a better job of planning our future, and not only the cinema, but all the other things that we wanted to do to DCTV, and to make sure that we had the money to do it. So we took our foot off the gas pedal for about 6 months, and we've been coasting, and we're just about ready to put our foot back on the pedal.
That's good. Sometimes it's better to do exactly that than to forge ahead regardless of circumstances.
Well, I've been impulsive at different times in my life, and sometimes we've benefited from that, and sometimes the mess that gets made needs a long time to clean up, so we're trying to be careful.
Yeah, I imagine, because you're a filmmaker as well, that at sometimes you have to grab the opportunity when it comes, even if maybe all the... maybe you haven't set everything up exactly right, but this opportunity may not be available. As a documentary filmmaker, sometimes you do have to kind of take certain leaps of faith in the project, yep. Right? And maybe that's what you're getting at, or variations.
We've jumped off quite a few cliffs in our time, and we've always managed to dust ourselves off at the bottom and keep going.
Yeah. Well, DCTV has been around, as you said, for around 40 years now, and it celebrated 40 years, I think, in 2013, is that right? And... So do you have a sense, because of what you just sort of described, that it's sort of entering a new phase? Does it feel that way?
I think that almost all the work that we're doing is directly linked to the original reason why we founded the organization. We believe that media could really push society in a good direction, give people opportunities they don't have, but part of that was enabling people to make their own media and giving them their own voice. And so all the things that we're doing are aligned with that. But I think that there's going to be a day at DCTV, and it could be tomorrow, when that bus comes barreling down Lafayette Street and I'm standing in front of it. There's going to be a day at DCTV that I'm not going to be here. And that other people are going to be carrying on the work that we started, and we're trying to ensure that that's going to make DCTV more successful and stronger than it is now.
But essentially, DCTV continues to be a resource for documentary filmmakers and also a place that generates storytelling.
Absolutely. And I mean, so whether it's... young people who otherwise wouldn't have an opportunity to tell their stories and to have them seen by people, or whether it's people with disabilities who need other people in society to understand the opportunities or lack of opportunities that they have, that's the work that we do.
Have there been any particular instances or experiences that come to mind that like shook you up in a way that, that you had, that maybe you can just share an anecdote? Because I with that kind of wealth of experience in one place, I wouldn't want to talk to you about this for hours, but I...
Sure. Well, I've been shaken more than the martinis that James Bond didn't have, because his were stirred. We get shaken all the time because we see things that disturb us and that we hope that we can fix. So, for example, very specifically with youth media, back in an earlier fiscal crisis in the late 70s in New York City, they decided that they were going to balance New York City's budget in part by cutting out what they determined were extracurricular activities for New York City high schools. No band, no drama, no dance, no sports. I mean, gone. When I went to high school, I would like to tell you that math class and science class were important to me, but in fact, it was these extracurricular activities that were the reason why I enjoyed going to high school. Mm-hmm. And the fact that a whole generation, millions of New York City kids, were going to be deprived of these, I thought was just absolutely un-American. And so we began teaching video on a voluntary basis to some of the schools that had their programs eliminated. And It was really exciting because many of these kids had difficulties academically with written English, writing English themselves, reading. But they had been watching TV and had a sort of innate knowledge of how television worked and took very strongly to making their own TV programs and telling their own stories. There was one day, this kid was in class. He was a Jamaican immigrant kid. And I noticed that he had this bulge sticking out of his boot in his pants leg. I said, what in the world's that? And he pulled out this huge butcher knife. And I said, "What? Why are you carrying a butcher knife? And why are you bringing it here to DCTV? And he says, well, I don't really mean to have it here at DCTV, but I have to fight my way to the subway in order to get here. My neighborhood is so dangerous that if I am not armed, I'm not going to make it safely from my neighborhood to DCTV. And I want to come to this class so badly that I'm carrying this butcher knife. It was a moment that really shook us, that people wanted the opportunities that we were helping them with so badly that they're ready to risk their lives to come here. That's a moment that shook me.
Thanks for sharing that one. Hopefully that's less of a case. Also, you know, it's funny you mentioned, because even I remember growing up in New York in the 70s, this area was kind of dicey. I mean, maybe a little north, maybe China.
This was sketchy.
Sketchy. Was a little bit north on Lafayette, but this was, you know, we're just short of, mm-hmm. south of maybe the Bowery.
My roommate got mugged in Cortland Alley over here.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. Well, there was all sorts of stuff going on.
Yeah. Then he ended up mugging other people to make things right.
No, this guy, okay. But there were two guys that were like fighting in the alley, rolling around, and one of the guys who was on the bottom goes, "Help me, help me." And so my roommate like charges into the alley to help, and they both got up and beat the daylights out of him and took his wallet. It was an interesting crime.
But you haven't had any run-ins like that in your time here?
Not that much. And DCTV as an organization is respected in the neighborhood. Everybody watches out for us.
Yeah.
We've been okay. But the lives of many of our students, our high school students, the things that they have to deal with, would cripple a normal person, would paralyze someone in a way that they just would be so overcome that they might not be able to move forward or might push them into a bad direction. So, for example, one of our young filmmakers was homeless through most of high school. I had a bedroom when I was in high school. I had some place that was my room. She never had it. Spent a lot of time on the subways, a lot of time couch surfing, and she made a film about it. And many people, when we were in high school, when we had problems, we hid these problems and we didn't talk about them. The bravery of our young filmmakers to deal with their problems and to sort of autobiographically make films about this has made them good filmmakers because they're dealing with subjects that are personal and passionate about.
And risk-taking.
Yeah, but they're very strong people as a result of this.
Right. So the youth media is a big part of, obviously, then, and it sounds awfully important to you, mm-hmm. but it's a big part of what DCTV does. And is this project, Our Cameras, Our Stories, an extension of that?
Yes, it is. So this is an opportunity for our young people who have been making these films about their lives, about being homeless, about parents being incarcerated, the difficulties of being an immigrant, struggling with bipolar disorder, looking for boyfriends, looking for girlfriends. All these things that comprise their high school years have been put into a series that's going to be shown on Channel 13. And Channel 13 has a very big footprint. There's 19, 20 million people that can watch these shows. It's a great opportunity for our young filmmakers to share their stories.
Well, tell me the schedule.
The premiere is this Saturday, the 4th of October, mm-hmm. at 1:30 in the afternoon.
Okay.
And then it continues after that for 5 more weeks. There's 6 shows altogether.
Okay.
It's going to live on the web. It's going to live on DCTV's website, dctvny.org.
Okay. So dctvny.org.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the first show has 3 parts, and it deals with Jasmine's story of being homeless.
This is the girl you were referring to just a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. Homeless in high school. It has Muhammad's story about being a Bengali-American teenager. And the sort of tug of war, his mother on one side wanting him to be righteous and study the Quran and not hanging around with his friends and doing things that I did when I was a teenager. It's a typical
immigrant story. Which formed you, though? Look how you turned out.
I did okay, but my parents were disappointed with me for many, many years. And Muhammad's mother's disappointed with him, but he's done okay. He's made a very, very good film, and he's getting honors grades in college now. So,
well, that is good news.
It's good. And then the last one is Natalie's story, and she comes from a Haitian-American immigrant family. She suffers from juvenile rheumatoid arthritis that makes part of her life a painful challenge.
Does it affect her walking or just everything?
She seems to be able to walk, but she has to take these shots that you see her taking, these shots while she's making her film, and they look like they really hurt. And her parents want her to be a doctor or to be a lawyer, and she wants to be a filmmaker, and so there's a struggle within the family of their dreams and her dreams, and she does a really good job capturing that. In fact, she's a super success story. Here in the Firehouse at DCTV, we supplement our income sometimes by being a holding house for movies that are being made. If they have a large cast, they'll come here to the ground floor of the Firehouse, and they'll house them here, they'll feed them here, they'll go to the bathroom here.
So, you mean like while they're waiting for the next setup or something?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And because we're near the alleyway here, that Cortland Alley, which is in every single dark scene in every movie that ever gets made in New York City.
And every episode of Law and Order?
Right. That's
the alley.
That's the alley that's in every film. And when your character's running through the alley and people are chasing him. And
to turn around.
It's around the corner from the Firehouse. And so I see Natalie coming down the street. And everybody in the movie knows her. And the director knows her. And the people who were working on it said, Natalie, what's that around your neck? And she had a white ID card. And this was Mutant Ninja Turtles 4, and she's the assistant editor on Mutant Ninja Turtles 4, and has really succeeded in what she wanted to do, make a life for herself in movies. And there's an HBO series that is being shot somewhere in the neighborhood here, mm-hmm. and she's working on that till the springtime, so she's doing well.
Pretty ambitious, right?
Yeah.
This is the one with the rheumatoid?
Yeah.
Arthritis? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so she shot this thing at DCTV's like last year or something. She shot it with the help of the FDCTV, with the help of the resources.
She did everything.
She did kind of on her own.
Her and her sister did all the camera work.
Okay,
she did all the editing. The thing that distinguishes the films that our kids make is that they really make them. Mm-hmm. That there are some programs that are a nice program for kids, and movies get made.
But they're heavily mentored.
But the kids are sometimes the subjects or the cheerleaders in the movies as opposed to the makers.
I see.
Our kids make them.
Gotcha. And this is you mentioned two, I think, other filmmakers. You said there was
three.
Okay.
Jasmine, who's homeless. Muhammad, who was defining his Muslim American identity.
And
Natalie,
Who
was trying to figure out what career path. And so each show has a theme.
Gotcha.
Some of the themes are young men of color and the particular road that they have to walk in New York City. There's a young women film series. There's a self-identity series and how our kids sort of shape who they are.
So there's
six different episodes.
Or episodes, uh-huh. Right. And who curated them, by the way? Or was it a group
effort? I mean, Johnny Ramos is the director of this program, and so Johnny Ramos and I sort of just began going through the Pro TV films and selected these, and each film is introduced by the filmmaker, so you get to meet the filmmaker and understand what he or she looks like and how they talk.
Mm-hmm. And so that goes on, then a six-part documentary series mm-hmm. of original films created by the talented youth in the Pro TV Media Arts Training Program.
Yeah.
The series premieres on WNETV, as John said, it was Channel 13, on October 4th, and will air on consecutive Saturdays at 1:30. Our Cameras, Our Stories is, I guess, the overall series title.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's a great opportunity for these guys, right?
Yeah, super duper.
It's funny, on the other end of the spectrum, I just came from a Press and Industry New York Film Festival screening of Al Maisel's new film.
Well, does he have a new film? What's it about?
Iris Apfel, APFEL. She is a 90-plus-year-old mm-hmm. woman who's in the... I don't want to say she's a fashion maven because it's too simplistic. She just had a lot of influence on a lot of fashion. She's kind of... she's more almost like a curator too. Like she just has had.
Oh, I.
She's an older.
She wear like funny knit hats and
big
and,
glasses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And very colorful.
Yeah, yeah. I met her by accident. We had a meeting with a very talented Pakistani filmmaker, and it was a there was some event in Lincoln Center about superwomen filmmakers, superwomen academics, and this Pakistani filmmaker was at that event, and we were waiting for her in the sort of snack place at Lincoln Center, and what's this woman's name?
Iris.
Iris. And her pal were there, and we looked at each other, and we smiled at each other, and the next thing you know, we were all sitting at the same table, and Iris was telling us very interesting stories.
I'm sure, yeah. She's had quite a life. I mean, so her husband was with her? She had a mate with her?
As another woman who eclectically dressed.
Yes. Nicely put. Yeah, because her husband, many, obviously, years, he turns 100 in the film.
Wow. It's just a pretty amazing. That's cool. Well,
I love that because that makes me middle-aged, like I still have.
That's true. You know, I'm at the stage in life, you know, where places where I used to be the youngest of whatever group was, whether it's youngest filmmaker, youngest hockey player, I'm the oldest now.
Yeah.
I had, this never happened to me before, we were playing hockey, not this week, but last week, and the guy on the other team was being a real jerk. And so at one point, he wanted to fight me. Now, up to this particular point, I was always the enforcer on the hockey team. I hold the team record for penalty minutes, never to be broken by anybody else. They always say records are made to be broken. My record will never be broken. And I was always the guy that if there was somebody was causing trouble, I would deal with it for the whole team. And all of a sudden, the whole team is like in between me and this guy saying that if you're going to fight John, you got to fight me first. And it was nice because they were sticking up for me, but they were sticking up for me because I'm old.
Older than you were. I'm much younger than that now. I know the phenomenon. You might be a few years older than I am, but I know the feeling exactly as you just described it, where you used to be the youngest in the group, and then seemingly overnight you're the oldest in the group. And I don't recall any middle period there where I was in the middle.
Yeah.
And
you start getting lifetime achievement awards that you don't really deserve. Or there's this sound. Okay, you have to guess what this is. Beep, 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 beep.
Well, it sounds like a SUV backing up or a bus backing up.
So it's the sound that the big golf carts make at the airport that carry people from gate to gate. They stop for me now.
They used to run you over.
And they just
you mean
wait.
Like to pick you up or
yeah,
just to,
no, no, no,
oh.
to pick me up? And,
oh, that's
and, yeah, that's something new.
But you just I you know
beep,
for those
beep you know you look in there and the ladies there are like
do you
why aren't you getting on my cart?
Yeah.
But I want to say that the gate to the LA flight is way at the end, and I was carrying a very, very heavy camera bag. When I actually looked at myself in the mirror, I was sort of bent over double, and so I understood why they were stopping.
Right.
And I got on. And it's really, like, I'm glad I got on.
Me too. With all that heavy gear, yeah. But I get the point, though. But you, those who, you know, have not met you and who are listening, you're fit, and you're obviously in good shape, and you're you seem pretty healthy, at least on the surface there. I don't know what's going on under the skin there, but
I actually lied the last time I filled out. Oh, geez, I shouldn't say this. I lied the last time I filled
nobody's
out
listening.
My,
don't worry.
embed papers for the Army when we were going to Afghanistan because they ask a number of questions about what you can and cannot do. Can you jump down from so many feet, and can
you
run?
Yeah.
And those two things I can't do anymore. I can walk, but I can't run. But
distances, or they're asking if you're motivated because you're hearing gunfire behind you. You can run.
I would actually be a liability.
I think. Okay.
And in the past, I wasn't a liability. I'd be a liability now. But it also, when we work with the young filmmakers that we're working with, their sense of excitement and their pride at being able to tell and share their story is so invigorating that it really helps energize our organization, every organization, sort of at some point, well, we're doing this again, we're doing this again, and no matter how good they do it, can use the sort of energy of young people or people who are doing things for the first time. The first time I had my film on TV, I knew it was getting written up. I was waiting at the newsstand for the New York Times to be delivered because I just couldn't resist for a second longer being able to see something about this.
Today's version of hitting refresh.
Right.
Until
and you know, we don't do that anymore. But the pride that our young filmmakers feel because their show is going to be on Channel 13 is just stupendous.
Can't imagine.
Yep.
And then to be able to say, look, Ma, look, Dad.
Yep. And the mom and dads are showing up at our screenings, too, and are also bursting with pride.
Well, why could they not?
But some of the parents, actually, it was interesting, don't know about these films, and especially about some of the films that are dealing with difficult family issues.
Sure.
They don't know what's going to they know the films have been made. They've seen the films. There's one family in which Zion is making a film about his brother. His brother's gay, his brother's a makeup artist, and the father is having difficulties accepting this. And there is one of the great documentary scenes in a car in which Zion and the brother are trying to get the father to say, yes, my son is gay, and that's okay. And he just can't say it. And to Zion's credit, he doesn't let the father off the hook. And so you're sitting in that car, and you can feel the tension in that car as these three young New York men are dealing with this. It's a great scene.
And to find out how it turns out, you'll have to tune in.
Watch our cameras, our stories. You just have to watch it.
Good cliffhanger, John. Where did you grew up? Did you grow up in New York City?
Or I grew up in Portchester, New York, which is 20 miles north of here. Mm-hmm. But I've been living within a block of the firehouse since 1968, so that's a long time.
See, you live in the immediate neighborhood still? Still to this day?
Yeah, because DCTV was born in a small loft on Canal and Center Street, which is the next block.
Quarter, yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. When did you know you wanted to be a filmmaker?
Well, I never thought that I'd be a filmmaker.
Didn't
think that making films was... I had just no conception of anything like that.
Well, for context, there was no...
There were no film classes.
There was no language for what you're talking about.
Not really. And certainly none of the equipment that we use, the predecessors of our stuff, the early video equipment, had not been invented yet. And I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker, or let's put it this way. I first appreciated the power of film to transform things back when I was a taxi driver, and this would have been around 1972, and we were trying to fight for better working conditions for our fellow cab drivers. And we had a sweetheart...
Very dangerous job.
...union, dangerous job. They were killing... on the average, one or two cabbies every month. The junkies were preying on us. The bosses were stealing from us. The union was stealing from us. The cabs were death traps. And we were fighting for better working conditions, and we were failing spectacularly. And it's very difficult to organize cab drivers. They're basically individual workers. You'll cut me off to steal my fare. It's not the type of solidarity of a factory floor where it's all the workers.
And now that works towards the boss's advantage.
And so we were losing. Mm-hmm. And one day decided to make a little video about this. Keiko had sent away to Japan and gotten one of the early video cameras and was using it primarily to document artwork. And I said, hey, let's make a film about everything we've been fighting for and let's show it to the cab drivers. We were meeting once a month over at the church on 9th Avenue and around 28th Street, 29th Street. It's a church they called the Gay Church in those days. Mm-hmm. So it was the only place where
they would
allow gay parishioners to have their own church. And they would allow taxi drivers to have meetings there. And so we showed this film, and it was unbelievable. It was like waving a magic wand over these cab drivers. And all of a sudden,
power film
banded together. Yeah. We began winning all the elections in the shops, and it was an exciting moment in which we understood the power of media to sort of get people
galvanizing.
It worked.
Effect.
And then we began doing that here in the neighborhood. And all the issues that we've been fighting for as amateur community organizers, better hospitals, better schools, better jobs, better housing, and failing in all these things, once we began making films about this, we weren't failing anymore.
Mm.
And that's really what got us excited about making films.
It's great. Never quite heard a story like that before, but it makes complete sense. It's sort of a happy accident. It's just this great discovery. It's like you untapped this wellspring in a way, you know, and
we
quite by accident.
We weren't smart enough to imagine this in a theoretical way,
yeah.
But once we saw it happen, we
in
were
practice.
Smart enough yeah. to understand it.
Yeah. So what did you? So you weren't a filmmaker. You were probably
a cab
doing
driver.
Cab driver. Mm-hmm. And you, when you were driving in those first years, you. Never, you didn't envision something else after that, or did you just figure?
No, because cab driving was a job that you could do a couple
sure.
of days a week, and those days you could work for 3 or 4 days a week and survive. Our rent was $75 a month. We had rigged up the electric meter and gas meter, so we didn't have to pay for our utilities. So $75 a month went pretty far. I knew what time the coffee shops in Chinatown would empty out their steam cabinets, and these guys who ran these coffee shops were my buddies, and I would get boxes of free chashu baos and other things to eat. The sandwich man at the municipal cafeteria downstairs, Victor, was my friend, and if you showed up there 11 o'clock at night, what he was throwing away, you could get. In those days, it was, unfortunately, chopped liver, because that was the thing that
literally
never
yeah.
finished. And so I ate a lot of chopped liver sandwiches. If you went to Katz's Deli and you paid the sandwich guy $1, he would fill up a huge wax bag that the industrial bread loaves came in. It was about 2 feet long with the tips of the pastrami. That were sort of around his workstation.
Yeah.
And it was in quotes for your dog, but in fact, that's what we ate. And so we had gotten sort of survival in New York down to a science of minimal working, and nobody wanted to work for the man. This was during the Vietnam War.
Right.
We were all...
What we call the counterculture, right? I mean, now.
I wasn't a hippie, and I wasn't mm-hmm. a pot smoker, and my hair wasn't long. I wasn't making a cultural protest, but I certainly wasn't interested in going down and working Wall Street. I wasn't interested in working in corporate America. I'm not sure what we wanted to do, but we sure knew what we didn't want to do. And there were lots of things in America that we thought really needed to be fixed, and we wanted to fix them. We didn't want to waste our time as bond salesmen or something like that. We wanted to get better housing. We wanted to have better educational opportunities. We wanted people of all races to have equal opportunities. So these were the things that we were fighting for. We just weren't succeeding. When we began making films about the horrible health conditions, the third world type health conditions that we had here on the Lower East Side in Chinatown, things began to happen. And it was part of the successful movement to have a community hospital built here, staffed by the community and oriented towards the needs of the community. We had an incredibly corrupt school board here, stole all the money, hired all their cronies. Kids were falling behind. Parents were really upset. They wouldn't let the parents talk at any of the school board meetings. Mm-hmm. When the parents got up to talk, they would call the tactical police force in and beat the parents up. Nobody believed this. We didn't believe it. We came with our cameras one day, and that's exactly what happened in front of our cameras. And that caused...
In front of the cameras, too.
That's
how they deal with impunity, in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
They knew they would never have to pay any kind of price for it. It's an incredible story. I was going to say, you know, this morning I read that the freelance union, workers union, dropping their health benefits for their members.
Okay.
So it sort of seemed, as you talk, I realize, you know, yes, you're right, it helps, but it's like we still seem to be at war. We still seem to be dealing with health crises and financial crises as much as ever. Mm-hmm. It's like, so there's no...
You sort of can't stop. You can't take anything for granted. And you have to keep fighting to make your neighborhood a better place, your city a better place, your country a better place, the world a better place. And one of the weapons that we have at our disposal are our cameras.
Well, thank you. Again, we'll just mention with great enthusiasm that Our Cameras, Our Stories, a six-part series on WNET, that's our local PBS affiliate here in New York, will be showing films by our youths, our future of in filmmaking, documentary filmmaking, certainly, and on Saturdays at 1:30 on WNET. They're also... At some point, would you hold off on showing, putting these on the internet?
No, we're going to put them on the internet as fast as we can. And as soon as we finish this interview, I'm going over and we're going to start editing the segments and preparing to put them on our website, which is dctvny.org. And the name of the series is Our Cameras, Our Stories.
Well done. And hopefully there'll be a season two. If,
that'd be great.
Because I think it's such a
there's more
amazing
stuff left on the shelf.
I bet. And and there seems to be no end to kids with cameras these days. So thank you for
cool.
And hopefully come back on. We'll talk some more.
Looking forward
soon.
To it.
Thank you.
Throughout most of my high school years, I've been homeless.
My parents are from Bangladesh. And I'm an American Muslim.
Islam, it's like a job. You gotta pray 5 times a day.
I'm ready to move on and be somebody more than just being fat. I'm ready to be who I want to be.
Homosexuality is not a choice. It is something you are born with.
And nobody's born with that. Nobody was born with one leg. Nobody was born with one eye.
See how you just disturb my high?
My mother uses drugs. My father uses drugs. My uncle uses drugs. Maybe it's in my genes to use drugs.
I was afraid that I would be a single mother. And I was afraid that I would be alone.
What's in jail for, if you mind?
Murder.
I've lost over 36 friends to gun violence.
This is my gun now. This is what I shoot. This is what I roll up. This is what I sell.
I'm 17 years old and I have arthritis.
Okay.
I'm going to college and I'm going to make films. Starting now.
And that was John Alpert from DCTV, and now we go into my conversation with the Israeli filmmaker Vanessa Lapa regarding her new hybrid documentary feature, which is currently playing at the Film Forum here in New York City, anyway, for the next couple of weeks. So you have another roughly 11, 12 days to see it, and it is at the Film Forum. And it's about the letters and diaries of Heinrich Himmler and his family. And although it may sound like a dour experience, it is really not. It is fascinating. And yes, disturbing, very disturbing, but in ways that we're going to discuss in my conversation coming up, and that may surprise you. So give a listen to the conversation with Vanessa and then, you know, think about seeing it. It's being distributed by Kino Lorber, as it were. So, you know, it'll have a life out there, and I hope we get to see it. My conversation with Vanessa Lapa.
Who do you think was responsible for the concentration camps?
Ich denke, für die Lager war es mein Mann.
Mein guter, wilder Geliebter, du bist schon wieder ein reines Reisebüro. Warum gehst du zu einer Hitlerversammlung? Du weißt doch, was er redet.
Anstalte doch diese Versammlungen. Und bin mitverantwortlich dafür. So bin ich bei vielen nicht beliebt. Gestern Abend war ich sehr ernsthaft und deprimiert. Wollte um 5:30 aufstehen, zum MG schießen und dankbarerweise den Wecker überhört. Schäme mich. Ist das noch soldatisch? Das Entsetzliche heute in Deutschland ist, dass die Frauen nicht mehr Mütter sein wollen. Wären wir noch so, wie die alten Germanen mit ihren Sitten und ihren gesunden Einrichtungen waren. Ein königliches Geschlecht.
Okay, Vanessa Lapa, it's very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And congratulations on this documentary, The Decent One. Puts one in an uncomfortable place to watch this, because even though I may have grown up well after the Holocaust, in our minds, in our imaginations, they were monsters. And in a way, these documents that we hear throughout the film, they humanize him. His letters to his wife, his mistress. So that's a byproduct. And I wonder if you had been hearing that, or if that was part of what you were trying to do.
I've been hearing it, and I definitely feel as uncomfortable as you feel. It's part of what we felt while doing the film, and it's definitely something that I hoped that the viewers will feel as well, this sense of discomfort, because it is not comfortable to see how easy it is for us as human beings to relate to him, to relate to the books that he read, to relate to the music that he was hearing. So I think that this is the challenge. It is definitely one of the challenges of the film, and it was important for me to allow the audience to experience the story, to be part of the story, not to look it from the side. This was one of the reasons why we decided not to have narrators or interviewees or guiding voices to allow the viewer to feel and to think with, to be part, to be in 1914 in Munich, and not to see from the side how Munich in 1914 looked like.
Right, and there's no judging. It doesn't appear to be any agenda. You're smiling.
I'm smiling because I'll take it as a compliment, because, of course, you know, the aim is to have it not appear, but every frame, every word was well thought about and chosen in order to make a point, of course.
Okay, well, I should take a small step back, because you attain basically documents, letters, photographs. What else? I mean, from
diaries.
Thank you. From that belonged to Heinrich Himmler, who was the head of the SS, one of the architects of the Holocaust.
The architect of the Final Solution.
After he fled, his family was sent away, right? His daughter and his wife, and he left. The house was overtaken by American GIs in the final days, obviously, the war. And they came across all these documents, and they basically stole them. I mean, right?
Yeah, they stole it, but it's not something, you know, it's not something not common in war, post-war areas. I don't think that they realized, you know, it's young men, 20 years old, and they see some things that instead of handing them over, they're keeping it to exchange it in a bar for a bottle of whiskey, for example. They didn't hand it over to the American authorities.
Right. So do we think that they knew what they had, but they didn't know what they really, the weight of it? Or did they know whose house it was?
Yes. Okay. I was not there. I hope they knew. Mm-hmm. It was, I'm sure they knew. The American army was well trained and knew what they did. And they sent soldiers to empty the houses of all the high ranking Nazis. Mm-hmm. So they knew exactly where they were. They knew what they were looking for, which is basically everything, all the documents, everything that can, all the belongings and all the documents. If they knew specifically that this is the private letters that he sent to his wife, I don't think so. And again, it's something very common in war zones and in post-war.
Yes, sure.
moments that soldiers are just taking, you know, a nice candle just because it's nice, and then they're selling it for a few bucks. So it's not,
right,
they are not thefts. I mean, according to me.
Okay, I agree. Okay, that thank you for learning me. Basically, this booty was split between two soldiers who went on their ways, and over the years, it's turned up, basically.
Yes.
And for some reason or other, someone with the same last name as you got hold of them, and they passed it along? Is that what happened?
No,
happened? Am I mythologizing the story a little too much? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
What happened is that there is a gap between 45 and 60.
Mm-hmm.
It went from hands to hands. We would never know because everyone is dead. In the early 60s, it got to a man named Chaim Rosenthal, who kept it under his bed for 40 years. And
yeah, that's a great part of the story. I just
love
that.
Yeah, it is. It's another film, definitely.
That's what I thought, too. Yeah. I had the same thought when I was reading about this.
Yeah, it is another film. And he, in 2006, he decided, together with his son, that it's time to get rid of it and to give it to someone who will do something important with it. So his son spoke to a professor at the Tel Aviv University who knew my father, who knew me. They called me. So this is how it came to my ears, and the only reason that the production company purchased it, or that my father purchased it for the production company,
for Real Works.
Yes, for Real Works.
Which is your company.
Exactly.
Okay.
For Real Works is in order to make a film out of it, for not for any other reasons.
Okay, and we'll get to that in a minute, because I want to ask you how you were going to tell the story. There are a lot of choices you could have made. Were people looking for these documents ever? Do you know?
The very restrained academic world who is looking all the time for new material and for never published before and for information to close gaps and to complete history. They knew that some of them knew. There were rumors in the academic world that part of the Himmler private collection is somewhere, and probably in Israel, but no one knew exactly where. And
they knew, they had a sense that there might be documents in
they
Israel.
Knew, yeah, they knew,
or they knew that it was because of.
In the 80s, Rosenthal tried to approach a few press people and the universities, but he didn't himself really knew what he had, and on the one hand, he didn't want to give it away, but he also didn't want to sell it away because of moral reasons. So in the very restrained academic world, people knew that it is in Israel somewhere.
Mm-hmm. So you did get these documents finally, and you knew already what they were, so by the time you got them, right?
I knew that it is the private correspondence and diaries of Heinrich Himmler, and that it was written between 1927 and 1945, and that it was never meant to be published, unlike the Goebbels diaries, who were written by Goebbels with the aim and the knowledge that it will be published. This was clean, without an agenda, because it was not meant to be published.
Sure.
This is what I knew.
Before you started to have them translated, or maybe
first transcribed,
excuse
me, because it is written in all German, so first transcribed and then translated in order for me to understand it good enough to write a script, although I understand German. My German is not good enough to.
You're Belgian born, but you've been living in Israel for many years, right? Before you read them, though, did you have some thoughts about what they may be like, and then were you surprised in particular?
No, the first year I thought that the documentary would be on how they came from Gmund to Tel Aviv.
Gmund is where the house was.
The house, from Himmler's house. And then I realized that they may be, it was not a really interesting story because we don't have answers to anything. And I realized that they may be a bigger story in or more important and interesting story, and definitely a more cinematic story in the content of the collection. So I took the chance to transcribe and translate the content. I was also curious.
Sure. How could you not be? But not only that, there would be a cinematic story in potentially there in the content, but also in the how it contrasts again to what I started off saying to the monster, this monster. Right? How did you reconcile these things, or did you? Do you want me to repeat that?
You mean you reconcile with myself or with the film?
The latter, because in other words, here you have this guy who. Now all of a sudden we're introducing he's a dad, not the perfect husband.
what you're suggesting is the affair he had, but for me, you know, a perfect husband is not something that you judge if someone has one has an affair or not. I think that for me there is the character of Himmler is not a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It is one normal man. Who did choices, unfortunately for all of us, the bad choices or the wrong choices. He was a seemingly good husband, but not a real good husband, again, according to, you know, to me. You know, getting a love letter before the wedding that from your husband-to-be that he loves you very much, but there is something that he loves a little bit more, and it's the fatherland. So for me, it's not close to perfection. To have a father who
his country
teaches,
first.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. I said who put his country first, but go ahead.
Yes, who put his country first, or his work is not the husband I dream about anyway, or at least not, you know, if it is the way he is, at least don't say it like this.
Yeah,
I know it if it's like this, and if I am okay with it, then, but sure. When you write me a love letter, just don't mention
That part.
And as a father, you know, to involve your own daughter up to that extent to what you are doing and to the war and for her to know that there is war is not protective at all. So I don't see a real good father. I see a seemingly good father and a very twisted man, definitely, and a twisted father as well. But for me, there is one Himmler. It's not a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde character.
Right. Well, again, that almost by going there and deciding, or rather interpreting it, that there are these two people or two sides, two personalities, is to rationalize how somebody can do, you know, like that this is not the real human being or that they have this compassionate side. But there it's both. It's people have the capacity for both. That's kind of what was the most disturbing thing is that we could, any man could be a Himmler the point. Okay, so when you were starting to construct the film in your mind, did you have different thoughts about how you might want to execute it? Because ultimately you chose to have actors provide voiceovers reading from the letters in the diary.
Once I started to read the content of the collection, I very soon realized that there is way enough material and content to tell a story without the intervention of psychologists, survivors, historians, Germans, Jews. The story is there. The big challenge is how to tell it in a good storytelling way. In a not boring way, how you know, what to choose in order to make the point that we want to make. But it was once we started to enter the content of the collection, it was obvious that the film is there. I mean, the film will be the content of the collection because this is the interesting, the challenging, the important story to tell. And the choice of the actors, the decision of taking actors is, you know, until today I don't know another way to have someone read the words of someone who is dead. And the choice of the actors was a very well casted process. We did it with, I mean, the one who cast the actors is the Austrian producer. We choose the actors that have the same age and the same, that are coming from the same area and the same accent and that are close enough to the story and good enough actors to, again, to allow the audience to feel that they are part and that it is not acting, because it is not acting. You need actors to read it in a coherent and accurate way, but there is no word that was invented or reenacted or written. It's only the words of Himmler and his wife, daughter, mistress, subordinates, mm-hmm. father.
Mm-hmm. Did you consider doing it in different languages? Or
I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I hoped that once the film will be done, the different countries, in case they would be interested, wouldn't ask to do it in different languages, because although it may ease, we are often thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know, it would be it's a difficult film to bear. It's a difficult film to understand. It's very loaded with layers of information. So for someone who doesn't speak German, it's very difficult to read the subtitles, because it's another level of concentration. It takes your mind to concentrate on the subtitles. So there are a lot of positive sides in having it in different languages, in other languages than the original language. But it would, I mean, in my eyes, it would damage the essence of the film, which is, you know, authenticity and based on the words and the footage that we're using is not propaganda footage. So everything goes in the same line. So having an Israeli actor or an American actor reading a German is would be, you know, I can imagine it, and I think it would be cool, and it could be enjoyable, but it's another film again. Right. It's
yeah.
something
it would take
else.
It somewhere else. Yeah. And do you think of this film as a documentary, as a narrative film, or something else?
I think that, you know, it's in the essence, it is exactly where the documentary and the feature they meet each other, because everything is 100% accurate. No reenactments, nothing that was not written. There are things that I wanted to tell, or good stories that are not in, because Himmler didn't write anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it is documentary, but in parallel, the fact that we don't use the conventional documentary techniques of reenactment, interviews, talking heads, the space that we try to give to the audience to enter the world and to feel with and be part is more of a feature, a more feature characteristic. So it is somewhere. It mm-hmm. is a documentary, but with a cinematic documentary, you know, aimed for the big screen.
It had its world premiere at Berlin.
Yes, it premiered at the Berlin Film Festival.
How was that? Well, that's, I mean, it makes sense. And then also, what a great festival to premiere a film in, of course, right? You know, it's like one of the great world cinema festivals right today. What was that like, and what was the response? How did people respond to it?
I will split my answer in two, because mm-hmm. since then we had the cinema release in Germany. So if you would have asked me,
there was a theatrical.
2 weeks ago, I would say that the reactions in Germany were very difficult, not of the industry, but of the audience.
Festival audiences.
Festival audiences.
Yeah, right.
The German audience.
The public audience.
Had difficulties to, you know, the sense of discomfort that you spoke about and we spoke about in the beginning for them is multiplied, because...
Yes, their grandfathers.
Yeah. Exactly. It's mm-hmm. their language as well. It's their it's private home movies that they have exactly the same ones.
They're right. Familiarity. It's too
so close. It's too wow. difficult. So it was, they were very emotional and you know, angry.
Angry at what, if I can ask?
I'm not a psychologist, but probably angry at first at the fact that they are reminded of it. Angry that maybe they... parents did it, angry because they may feel guilty, although they are not, and nothing in the films points out that they have any responsibility of what their parents and grandparents did. So it's too close to them, so they just reacted very emotionally and very involved, but very emotionally. Mm-hmm. The reactions 2 weeks ago were very different because the audience was very caught by the way of telling the story and the amount of visuals that they all know and see a film that is telling the same story but in a different way was very interesting to them. So the reactions were really amazing in Germany.
So what you're saying is that the initial audiences that paid for their festival tickets, those people may have been the most, maybe felt the most sense of urgency to see this particular film because of the content and the subject matter.
Yeah, it's too soon to say, you know, we had 4 screenings during the Berlinale and now for 1 week we are 1 week into the theatrical release. I was at 2 Q&A, so I can only say about, I don't know, the press is good and I guess it's a matter of age, a matter of who is coming to see.
And they did have more press to read before and choose to come to see your film this time, or because they had a little bit more information.
Yes, exactly. Because at face value, it's, you know, again, and they just don't want to be reminded of it, and I understand them.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, in Israel either. I mean, all over the world, it's, you know, it's not entertainment, and no one really wants to, including me, to be reminded of this horror or another horror. Or
were you conflicted about doing the film because you knew we do have a lot of Holocaust documentaries in any given year?
No, I was not conflicted, not at all. I was challenged. I really, really wanted to do it in the way it's done.
Right.
To me, it's not a Holocaust movie.
Right.
It is a film, you know, that is using one family and one historical event in order to tell a bigger story, and I hope that although it appears to be again about the Holocaust and who cares about Heinrich Himmler, people will make the effort to see it because it tells a way bigger story or a way more important story and you know, than the private diaries of Heinrich Himmler, which are not really neither important or interesting. But once you put them in the context, then they become very important.
And I guess we might have a few more minutes here, so I'm just curious about your company, RealWorks. Also, I should ask, when did you migrate to Israel?
I moved to Israel. I was 19 years old, which is 20 years ago.
Okay.
Zionism. Emotions.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah? It was more than emotion. Well, it must have been intellectual.
No, what made me go there was purely emotions.
Yes.
And, you know, like everything, when you are emotional, you're disappointed. But at the end of the day, I am still there. I'm lucky enough, you know, to... I worked at the news, so I traveled a lot, and with the documentary films, I'm traveling a lot. So, yes, I'm still there.
Gotcha. And the and RealWorks then is a production company, right? That you produce through RealWorks, the journalistic documentary TV production. Is that what it is? Mostly.
RealWorks is an independent production company who's doing on the one hand documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
RealWorks produced one TV documentary and now the decent one. It's the second documentary.
Oh, okay.
And RealWorks is developing the restoration facility that we had to bring in and to set up for the decent one.
Mm-hmm.
And doing sound design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there must have been the archive. I obviously worked it out because you're having theatrical engagements around the world now, or at least in Europe and in the States. So you must have worked out the rights for all that.
All the rights.
Was that a time consuming?
It was a time consuming and a huge budget to be able to have the rights for
all media. Was it the biggest
line
item? Was that?
Definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
Without a doubt. Especially in a film that is archive only. So, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, the actors were pretty inexpensive by comparison.
Of course, they were.
Yeah. Yeah, so how did you raise the majority of that? Did you do that through independent finance?
Well, slowly but surely, I started with the film funds in Israel and then the broadcaster in Israel. Yeah. And then I struggled in Germany, not able to bring a German broadcaster because of the approach. And then I was lucky enough to have Austria willing to pick up the challenge and believing in the way I wanted to tell the story. So Austria is a major financing source.
So they,
and then the Claims Conference Committee and other funds and some private equity, of course.
Did you play many Jewish film festivals? I was curious to know how that go. Or actually, you didn't have a lot of time to do that?
No, it's not a matter of time. It's a matter of the path that the film is taking. And we started with Berlin. We screened at we were selected at Telluride, so we didn't do anything for 6 months in any Jewish film festival in the United States. And now we're heading cinema release in Europe.
But
the Jewish film festival will definitely be part of, you know, the coming in
the
six
next
months,
phase.
The next year.
Right.
Definitely.
They're interested, in other words, regardless if you've had theatricals, because you're not opening so broadly that that the programmer might think, you know, why should we bother, right?
Although we are, you know, opening wide, the festivals are, for some reason, they see it as something different than what they usually have, and they are less focused and less, you know, focused on, because it had a theatrical release and X people saw it, then we don't want to show it. We have a lot of requests of special screenings from the ambassadors in all the countries and from the Jewish film festivals and from the Jewish museum, and on the other hand, from the academy and
institutional
the theaters for the moment. So.
Yeah, so it's pretty, I know a lot of filmmakers can actually do quite well when they have a film and it's in niche, we call it niche, but niche film festivals, because, you know, it's a great way, and it's actually a very effective way of distributing your film to the audiences that are looking for that kind of film.
It is, in our case, we were lucky enough, I was lucky enough to have a distributor like Kino and we were selected at Telluride. So the niches is for next year.
Well, best of luck.
One
more time, the film is called The Decent One. It's directed by Vanessa Lapa. It's a really fascinating and very memorable work, hybrid.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's another interesting hybrid documentary, but on a very different way, which is coming out today, Friday, October 3rd. It's called Last Hijack. Everyone at this point knows that there are folks from Somalia who are desperately, you know, they're desperate. They're desperately poor in most every case. And, you know, they go out and they get a fishing boat and they go out in the high seas into the ocean and they hijack ships that are carrying cargo across the sea, and they steal it and they sell it, you know, and that's how they make their living. And it's a highly dangerous way to try to eke out a living. Many people die on the sea or they are arrested, rightfully so. And but this, you know, it's like how do people get so desperate where they'll take such enormous risks, and do these dastardly crimes. Well, here's their view at it, because these two filmmakers, Femke Wolting and Tommy Pallotta, they both share a professional and personal relationship, and they made this film called Last Hijack, which is following Muhammad, who is a pirate. And this is his story, and it's an incredible tale, and it's shot beautifully, and there's lots of animation, and it's really beautiful. So I urge you to check it out. This is my conversation. We did it on Skype. I believe Vanessa was in Europe, potentially in Amsterdam. Not positive. I forget. And Tommy was here in the States, and I think in L.A. And this was our conversation on a three-way Skype chat.
صاحب كي وحو أهبر عد بدل وحانا مرك استئي شيء جري إنه نقضي نين تاجر وحيستل لبقل إيو كنتون كن أوتولا وحاو يوعد بني هوتيل قرح بدل وآد إي عجب كلي وحي أهاي هو آد وبرحونا دمان توت
Hey, this is Femke.
Hi, Femke. It's Adam.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good.
In my reading a little bit about you, are you a co-founder of Submarine?
Yes.
That's great. So you could talk a little bit about that. When did you co-found that company?
2000.
Wow. So you've been around a while.
Yeah. It's, long
time. I didn't realize it was around that long. So what are some of the early projects you guys did?
We always did a combination of film and more technology, interactive storytelling projects. So we did a film with Peter Greenaway. We did a documentary that was shown in the US quite a bit called Meet the Falcons.
Of course. Was that distributed by Kino?
Yes.
Yeah, because I'm at the Kino Lorber offices right now.
Oh, funny. Yes. Yeah. I'm now producing a feature film by Peter Greenaway about the Russian film director Eisenstein.
Yeah.
So fiction feature film is almost done. I just saw a rough cut today.
Oh, his love affair with Mexico.
Yes.
Yeah, I was reading about that. That looked great, too. Peter Greenaway is one of your very interesting filmmakers. I was just talking to somebody about Peter Greenaway maybe 2 days ago or something.
Oh, really? Oh, funny.
Yeah, well, you know, as a young man, I mean, I was blown away by the Cook, the Thief, you know.
Me too, which was one of the reasons why I wanted to become a filmmaker or be a working film, because film made a big impression on me when I was young.
Yeah, exactly. I walked out of there changed.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that doesn't happen as often. Maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, but that's great. So now you have a good, obviously a very close relationship with him.
Yeah, it's great. And we did like projects like Collapse as kind of an interactive documentary combined with a game, like kind of a game film. We've done interactive motion comics like Art of Foe. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of different things.
And how did you meet Tommy?
Well, before I had Submarine,
uh-huh.
I was making documentaries for VPRO, and I ran part of the Rotterdam Film Festival called Exploding Cinema. And it was kind of a curated. So it was a section of the festival that looked kind of at the future of film and technology.
Oh, sure.
And so we showed like some of the work that Tommy had been directing, and we kind of became friends. So we were friends for a decade before we kind of fell in love all of a sudden and then became partners.
Okay, so I don't normally venture outside the business side, or I should say the professional side. You guys are a couple?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't know that for sure. And how nice!
Yeah.
No, great.
Hello.
Hello, sir. Hey. How are you?
Great. Somebody came into the room that I was in, so I had to pick up my computer and move into an entirely new room.
Now, I appreciate that, and it's fine. We were just catching up a little. I was asking her about Submarine because I'm always interested in that, and it's a company with a great reputation that I've heard of over the years. And cool. I'm also, we were sharing our mutual admiration about Peter Greenaway.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
How are you, Tommy?
Good. Yourself?
Good, good. I'm of course, running around the New York Film Festival, so seeing some really wonderful movies. That remind me, I do have the press notes, but the Last Hijack is in the New York Film Festival, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's a great, great turn of events. And also,
yeah.
is
there is a theatrical in New York?
Yes, yes. I think it starts on Friday.
This Friday, Friday, right?
Yeah, Friday. I think it's at the Quad in New York, and it's also at the Downtown Independent in L.A. on Friday as well. And the other thing you should be aware of is that it's going to be released on iTunes exclusively for that first week as well.
Okay.
So any of your listeners outside of New York or L.A. can also see the movie.
Well, I hope they have iTunes because my podcast is mostly iTunes as well. That's great. So you're playing theatrically in New York and L.A.
Uh-huh.
Again, you'll be at the Quad. We're starting Friday, October 3rd in New York, and same day for L.A. at the Downtown Independent?
Yes, correct.
That's a great theater. And as well as going on iTunes.
Yes, exclusively.
So also day and date, right? Friday the 3rd?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Goodbye. No, I'm kidding. Last Hijack, dealing with an interesting timing in the sense that all of a sudden there are a crop of films about Somalian pirates and that type of thing, but yours is by far the most unique in the sense of that it is a hybrid film as you describe it. It has, it's rooted in documentary, but it has a strong narrative flavor to it as well as having a substantial amount of beautiful animation in there.
Thank you.
So it was always conceived as that, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, like when we first started reading about piracy and saw the like news footage from pirates, like the reason, like one of the reasons why we clicked to the subject is that it seemed such a great subject to make a hybrid documentary because mm-hmm. kind of the most essential part of the pirates, like the hijacks, we could never film because basically it would be compliant in a criminal act. And so we first thought the animation would be for kind of factual reconstructions of those hijacks and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we were further along in the film and we were editing, we just became less interested in that. And the animation became more a way to visualize the point of view of the main character, Mohammed, and the way he experiences the world. So it became a way to visualize his dreams and fears and also memories of the Civil War, but in a subjective way.
For those listening, Muhammad is a Somali pirate. He has been doing this for some time, and he's kind of trying to get out. He's certainly grappling with an ethical aspect of it, and it must be very hard once you're in and there's a lot of money potentially to be made, and then to come out of that and work hard for much less money is a difficult thing for anybody. And at the same time, he's also trying to become a family man. So he's trying to really change, but there's a lot of temptations, right, pulling him in other directions. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Throughout, there's as we said, the animation, and there obviously is a lot of imagery of the bird and flying, and I'm wondering if that's supposed to be so symbolic of what? Of Muhammad and the freedom he feels when he's out on sea? I mean, I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I think the beginning scene is really important to the movie and understanding what the relationship of the audience is to the live-action documentary part of the film. And I think that first scene, you see a man staring at the sea and building something, and then you realize it's a hook, and he throws it up, and then he starts to float away, which is sort of his desire to escape from the current situation that he's in. And then you see sort of a transformation, you know, from the man, which I think is the signal to really explain that this is a subjective point of view, a subjective reality. So at this point, you realize you're in his mind, and then you see the ship, and the sort of magnificent bird of prey, you know, goes and fulfills its nature, its destiny. And I think that explains and encapsulates a lot of sort of what the movie that you're about to see, you know, the kind of person that he is, but also, you know, how the animation is working in the context of this documentary.
Obviously, one of the other major films that came out of last year was Captain Phillips. And it's true, it does have an American or Western perspective to that film. Though it was very, I think it was managed to be somewhat sensitive to the Somalian characters, and we had a deeper understanding. But here with Last Hijack, we're entirely in the world of the Somali characters,
or
people, since they're also actual people.
Yeah,
I keep almost forgetting that it's also, this is really happening.
Yeah,
yeah. But I'm wondering what steps you took in order to respect and to put yourself in that in those shoes as filmmakers, storytellers.
Well,
you
I
shot
think
there obviously.
Yeah, I think you know, intent always comes through in storytelling, and I think that from our point of view, we really wanted to understand the situation, and it was part of, you know, our personal exploration of that. And I think, you know, we started out really with the question of like, what would you do to survive in a failed state? And I think that sort of automatically puts you in the empathetic, you know, viewpoint of trying to really understand what were the situations and conditions that led to where we are now. And I think it's on part of the movie's about trying to understand why Muhammad made his choices in life. And I think that's addressed within the movie. And I think the parents even say, like, he didn't have to choose this sort of lifestyle. But you want to understand the conditions around a situation that causes a person to make that choice. And even if you don't agree with that, you still see the parents and you kind of understand their point of view that they want to save their child from this kind of lifestyle. And I think that those are kind of universal themes and questions that we all have and we all understand no matter what the situation or the culture around us.
With this question could be for either of you. How much did you talk to Muhammad? Was he, by being involved, putting himself on the line in the sense that if he was going to continue to be a pirate, wasn't he taking
Well, he was, when we found him,
yes.
Like one of the reasons, like we had made research for a long time to find like our main character for the film, and many of the pirates want to retire outside of Somalia.
Yeah.
They want to go to Kenya or to the UK or just like basically leaving the country. And of course, then they would be very wary to talk to us or have their lives being filmed because in other countries there's a government and police and they would have a serious risk to be arrested. In Somalia, there's not so much risk for Muhammad, and he has no intention to leave the country. He feels Somalia is his home, mm-hmm. and he really wants to stay there. So that was one of the reasons why he was willing to open up to us and film, and why we could film his life and his family, because he doesn't really want to leave the country.
It can be a very lucrative business, I guess, but it could also be very, very, very dangerous for these guys, right? I mean, it's like a... It's very dangerous for those on the other end of this transaction.
Yes.
But these Somalians, most of them perish or are imprisoned, correct? I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Yes. And that was something we didn't know when we first started the research. But really, I think for a long time, the pirates were kind of heroes in their own country because people saw them as Robin Hoods. But so many teenage boys, like a whole young generation of men, basically disappeared because many of them can't swim. They drown or they get lost at sea. And now they are being jailed often in foreign prisons. So a large percentage of them just doesn't survive piracy.
Yeah.
Right. You don't hear about the pirates who never even make it onto a ship. I mean, the sea itself is perhaps one of the most dangerous aspects of it. And they go out on these really small, you know, fishing boats with very limited supplies, food, or water, often enough only in the hopes that they have to get a ship,
right.
You know, to get back. And you don't hear about the people who are just lost to sea very much, but it's very common and very dangerous.
Right. At best, they might have GPS, correct. But so they can see where the ships are as well as where they are.
Right. And as the sort of fight against piracy has intensified, you know, they're taking different routes, and the people that are attempting to hijack those ships have to go out further, and they're really just not equipped. I mean, the fishing boats that they have are really good for going out short distances, not for long distances.
Right. Yeah, they would have to bring a lot of extra fuel as well.
I'm thinking about
all the difficulties involved and how desperate one has to be to choose this.
Right. And we thought it would be more sophisticated. We thought that they would have the routes and be targeting, you know, specific vessels and things like that. But it's really not like that at all.
I mean, there are probably pirates that operate like that, but this is not representative of what we're talking about.
Correct, yeah.
Let's talk about you guys there then, like what that experience was like and integrating yourself in this part of Somalia. What was that like for you guys?
When we were researching the film, the idea was always that we would go and film. But then once the film was financed, which took about, I think, a year and a half, maybe 2 years, we were not able to get any insurances kidnap and intrusion on our life. And then there were two investors that were saying that they would withdraw their money from the film if we would go ourselves. So then we basically had the difficult, we had to make the decision whether we were going to give back the film and not make it or find a different way of making it. Mm-hmm. So we had been working with this really talented journalist, Jamal Osman. He's a Somali journalist. He helped us with the research, finding a number of pirates and doing pre-interviews and in the end finding Mohammed. And then he was a journalist for Channel 4 and he was used to working remote for Channel 4 with the director being in the UK. And so there's a great mobile phone network. So we then started, and the way he would work with Channel 4 is that he would be on the phone with his director in the UK and kind of discussing interview questions and things like that. And then we thought maybe this is a way we can experiment to make the film. And we found a very talented Somali DOP. And then they came to Amsterdam and we worked together to kind of discuss the visual style of the film and to talk about the visual approach. And then we wrote down a big part of the film through scene, possible scenes and interview questions and things like that. Mm-hmm. And we divided the shooting period in a few times, so there was also the possibility to evaluate in between. And then we would be on the phone with them a lot, kind of talking through scenes and events that happened, because of course we had written down a lot, but we knew once they would be on the ground, things would immediately change. And through the phone, we were able to keep close contact with them. And then they were sending footage out through FedEx to Kenya. There it was uploaded so we could watch it, give notes. Mm-hmm. And that's how we made the film. And it was very hard, of course, for us to not be there on the ground, but it was the only way to do it. And it also gave us something that, an intimacy with the characters, that they, as just a small team of two and being Somali, which would have been very hard for us to have achieved.
Were there many Westerners there? And did you encounter in the times that you were there?
None. No, there were no, it's just a very, there have been some news reporters and there's a hotel in Mogadishu where you can, big networks sometimes stay. And when you rent a room, it comes with a small private army of 15 guys and a bulletproof SUV.
Wow.
And people will go for a day or two to report about stuff. But of course, it's also when you're making a film, it's very hard to get any kind of intimacy when you turn up with your show up with a private army,
yes,
and have to film people.
So, what was the size? It was the two of you. You had this sort of liaison fellow you mentioned. You had this guy,
yes,
who was sort of interacting as in between. And then, did you have any other crew people, or you just
no, shot? Just them.
Yeah,
it was just two Somali guys.
Okay,
for the crew, the entire crew.
One guy holding a boom mic or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, there was Jamal and Ahmed, and it's just really, but just traveling because they had to travel all around Somalia, and even that's sort of really tricky, and it's dangerous there for other reasons besides just piracy too.
Oh, sure.
And so it was interesting.
Is there still infighting or?
Yeah, I think that it's still clan-based.
Clan is better. Did you have your world premiere, by the way? Where was that?
In Berlin was the world premiere, the Berlin Film Festival.
Oh, terrific, okay. And now you're at the New York Film Festival, it's great.
What,
and then I guess we have to wrap momentarily, but you have your theatrical and your...
And we, just launched the interactive version of it that's available now. So if people go to lasthijack.com, there's a whole, it's a companion piece, so it's really more about the history of Somalia, all the sort of machinations behind the piracy.
And it fits right in with your history of your work, you guys, the interactive side of it. And making it more engaging for people. And it's, again, it's called Last Hijack. And it's be playing in New York and L.A. starting this Friday, October the 3rd, as well as on iTunes. And then I'm sure further it'll spread to other platforms over time, I'm assuming.
I think at October 14th, it's available VOD everywhere.
Okay. That's great. Congratulations, then.
All right. Thank you.
Great meeting you both.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, guys. That was the show. I'm going to be back in a few days with another full show where we're going to talk about the Woodstock Film Festival, which is coming up a little later this month. And I'm also going to have a guest on, a filmmaker who was recently involved in the Independent Film Week, and I brought him on. He's a friend of mine. His name is Michael Wexler. He'll be on to talk about that experience and how he became a filmmaker. And also another filmmaker who is a young guy who's real talent and made a documentary that he's self-distributing called Persistence of Vision. His name is Kevin Schreck, and they'll all be on the next show. It's a very, very cool show, if I say so myself. So FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. This is your host, Adam Shartoff, signing off. Until next time, be well.
City, still wishing I was here, but now I